We're saying this is the second session of the interview with Mary Rouse, and it's now the 10th of March. I've been interviewing Paul Ginsberg, and he said the dean's office will be differently organized, and he wouldn't have liked it. So I would like to ask you what changes you made or were asked to make in the dean's office.
Well, I don't know that anybody specifically gave me any instructions, Laura, but it was clear to me throughout the interview process and also in talking with the new chancellor that the office needs to do more programming, and by that I mean programs that will reach larger numbers of our students as opposed to seeing a lot of students on a one-on-one basis. For instance, our whole plan to expand orientation for new students, new freshmen and transfer students, fits very nicely, into the plan, which means that, for instance, during the summer orientation, when students come in, right now they come in for one day, and we're going to have them come in for 2 days at the beginning of the summer, and then we'll plan a number of activities during registration week, welcome activities, and then probably teach an interdisciplinary course that will introduce freshmen to the culture, the history of the university, teach them about student services, teach them how to get in touch with academic advisors, with their dean's offices, with the writing lab, with the Guts Hash tutorial programs. In other words, we will plan programs that will work on prevention, trying to nip problems in the bud, so to speak, or trying to plant a seed in a student's mind such that if he's having trouble getting started on a term paper, that rather than giving up or quitting, that he knows that there's a writing laboratory and that he can get into the writing laboratory right away and get some help putting together that term paper, or that he needs to go and talk with his teaching assistant or his professor. The idea being that we want to work hard on retention. And I have this very idealistic notion that, well, first of all, I would like to see every student that wants to graduate from here. We don't admit students here that we don't think can cut the academic mustard. In other words, we think that everyone that comes here can make it. So I have a very idealistic notion about dramatically improving retention rates, because I think dropping out, particularly in a world as complex as our world is and where we need as many highly educated people as we do, if a student drops out, that's not only a loss to him or her personally, as well as the family, but it's a loss to, the general society. So I'm very idealistic, and I'm clinging hard to my notion that we want to improve retention rates. So I feel that if we can get freshmen, or get new students, by new students I mean freshmen and transfer students, really well connected from the beginning, starting with summer orientation, which means good academic advising and also teaching them varsity on the lighter side, if we can do that, that will pay off greatly in terms of our student retention. And I think folded into that is also the special efforts that we're going to make with minority students. Mm-hmm. That was a long answer to your question. So that's what we mean by programs, reaching more students, mm-hmm. and not only dealing with students that are in crisis, but hopefully spending a lot more time on prevention.
Whose idea was this?
Whose idea was this to expand orientation? Mm. I would say that, as in card games, it was a meld. Some of the ideas are clearly mine. I have felt for a long time that we haven't done enough with our new students. I would say great credit goes to Dr. Joe Kaufman, who is one of the nationally and internationally known professors in educational administration. He has just recently retired, and he has been sitting at my right elbow since in fact, he's one of the first people that I ask to come and visit me when I got my new job, and he has some very good ideas. Another key person in terms of my thinking has been Ernest Boyer, who is the president of the mm-hmm. Carnegie Commission on Higher Education, who in 1987 published a long report.
You mentioned that last time. Yes.
So he's certainly been a key person. Paul Ginsberg has been extremely important as far as the legacy that he has given to all of us in taking good care of students. And what we're trying to do is to take his legacy and refine it and change it in a way such that we're able to reach more students and reach them before they get to the point of crisis. So I'd say certainly, there are a lot of people that have been involved in advancing mm-hmm. these ideas. Interestingly enough, whether I talk with faculty about these ideas or students or parents, everyone is wildly enthusiastic about paying more attention to undergraduate students and particularly new students. Mm-hmm. I haven't had the only gentle criticism has been from students as far as, are we going to make this interdisciplinary course mandatory or is it going to be voluntary? The old controversy of should physical education be mandatory or should it be voluntary? And that's the only gentle criticism that I've heard. And of course, a lot of students bridle at the idea of a course that is, mandatory and would rather have it be taught on a voluntary basis or an elective, basis.
You said you had been thinking of this for a long time. Did you ever propose it before you became dean?
Another woman on our staff and myself, probably as long as 5 years ago, had this, what we thought was a great idea, where we would write to every new student living off campus and get them to, come to a series of small group meetings that we set up, and we involved some faculty members, other academic staff, and we thought it was an absolutely wonderful idea, and out of probably 3,000 students to whom we wrote letters of invitation and asked them to come to these meetings within the first couple weeks of classes, probably 25 or 30 showed up.
Now, these were all classes, just freshmen, obviously.
No, these were new freshmen and transfer students living off campus.
That many?
That many, because we have, coming in this fall, for instance, we have 5,200 freshmen and probably 1,000 transfer students. Mm-hmm. And we have a large numbers of students, several thousand students, living off campus. And so we wrote to all these students living off campus, and the response was not very good. I don't think we did as good a job of organizing it and promoting it as we could have. Also, again, I think even within the last 4 or 5 years, times have changed, and the interest that students have in getting better connected with the university has increased, and also obviously our interest in students has changed dramatically too. So anyway, I still don't think it was a bad idea. I think, we just didn't get it organized and publicized.
But what about expanding the SOAR program? Did you propose that?
We have been talking about expanding the SOAR program, and again, a number of people, for about 3 years, and I became a strong advocate of expanding the SOAR program after I took my own daughter to orientation at Berkeley and felt that Berkeley was doing a much better job than we were in terms of getting their freshmen connected. And so immediately after I came back from that orientation, which would have been the summer of 1986, I began to talk with Jack Kelsvig, who's in charge of the SOAR program, about taking a hard look at orientation. I think one of the biggest problems, Laura, has been money. For instance, dollars for orientation have been cut back so drastically in the last few years that that literally there has not been enough money to give a folder to a new student during orientation with material about the University of Wisconsin. Now, that's a very sad state of affairs. You know, we've had enough money to give folders to parents, but not to students, and there's something drastically wrong with a school that does not have enough money. You know, a school, I think, that is among the 10 or 12 greatest universities in the world. You know, if we can't find, you know, resources to put some materials in the hands of our new students, then we've got to stop and think about that and get, you know, reorganized and regrouped.
Well, how did you solve it?
Well, we're solving it this year, as a matter of fact, by expanding the summer orientation program slightly and reallocating some internal resources. And then with next year, when we want to dramatically change the SOAR program, we'll be making some requests to the chancellor for additional funds.
Well, so you're talking about funds within the Dean of Students office. You haven't gotten any additional help from the chancellor's office?
It's a little more complicated than that, and I want to make sure that I'm accurate. First of all, Laura, student services, maybe I should have said this at the beginning, is disaggregated at the University of Wisconsin. We don't have, as you know, a division of student affairs as they do at many institutions. So when we talk about student services, they're organized under different people. The SOAR program technically is a part of the Office of Admissions and New Student Services, which does not report to the Dean of Students, but rather reports to Joe Corey, who is the head of Academic Services. So what has happened is we in the Dean of Students office work cooperatively with the other student services units. So the money for the expanded SOAR program is actually coming out of the academic services budget. And our office provides a great deal of the staffing for the SOAR program, but we won't actually be putting any dollars in this year. By next year, we will be going to the chancellor with a comprehensive plan or an overall strategy to do three things. One would be to expand the SOAR program. The second would be to have a number of welcome week activities, registration week activities for new students. And thirdly, this interdisciplinary course that I'm talking about. If this effort, if this plan is to succeed, it's going to take the cooperation of the College of Letters and Science, of the other schools and colleges around the campus, of the people in academic services, and the people in the Dean of Students office. So what we're trying to do is to work on this together as a committee, and to cooperatively present a plan. I don't know if that's
so. It's not a problem of do any turf problems
arise
in this?
I don't think so. And I have been in very close touch with, for instance, the College of Letters and Science, which has 18,000 undergraduates, and I've been in touch with a number of the other schools and colleges, and everyone, as I say, seems to be very enthusiastic. And I think what happened with our new chancellor is that she came in and heard what we were how we were talking, and thought it was a good idea, and so she has given it a great deal of publicity. But I think we're all the horses are moving in the same direction. Mm-hmm. All the teams are moving in the same direction on this expansion of orientation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, would you talk about your view of what the Dean of Students office ought to be doing in the way of counseling, and compare it to what was done when Paul Ginsberg was here?
I guess I think about two approaches, and I feel very fortunate to had the benefit of what I said a few minutes ago, is the Paul Ginsberg legacy of taking really good care of individual people that get caught in the cracks of an institution of this size. So that's kind of one stream that is very important to me and has been very influential. At the same time, again, as I said, Dr. Joel Kaufman has been sitting at my right elbow, who is a person that talks more about programs for students. So I would see us as carrying a leadership role in the development of new programs for students, and at the same time making sure that if a student does fall through the cracks or is angry or is upset or is having some kind of difficulty, that we would be able to, you know, help that student. I see the counseling function that was done here in the Dean of Students Office as shifting more to our university counseling service. And one of the things, again, I talked about when I interviewed was the need to pour more resources into our university counseling service so that crises, acute mental health problems could be handled increasingly by that agency. It's no secret that we have the lowest ratio of counselors in our counseling service to students of any of the Big Ten institutions, and that we certainly need to improve the resources in our counseling service. For instance, we're not accredited in our counseling service as a training site by the American Psychological Association, which is very important for our trainees, and that's a long-term goal for me to get that accreditation. And so, again, I see the counseling as shifting more over to the university counseling service.
You see that, but somebody must have had to do it. I mean, to say this is going to shift.
Yeah, and that somebody is me.
Yes.
That's true. And again, we've talked about that as a staff. In fact, I think it's important, Laura, that you know that people work with me. They don't work for me. And that we have talked about all these issues. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about them since September, including having Dr. Kaufman in several different occasions and picking his brain and, you know, just thinking about where we want to head, you know, as a staff. And clearly everyone feels that the counseling service needs to be, you know, upgraded and improved in terms of resources.
Does that mean people who were doing counseling here on your staff are now not going to be doing much anymore?
I think they already are doing far less counseling. And again, I see my shifting some people around. In fact, I think I already have a couple letters on my desk from people who are working in one area and are excited, for instance, about these orientation efforts and think that it's time professionally for them to make, you know, a shift.
So they
and
just
so
assume,
I see,
fact,
yeah, I see some, I see some reassignments, you know, coming. And again, you know, what we're doing is not in any way a repudiation of what Paul Ginsberg did. It's simply a recognition that, you know, everything changes. You know, one of my favorite Greek philosophers said, I'm sure you remember this, you can't ever stick your toe in the same river twice, meaning that, you know, part of history is, you know, is change. And I see students as having changed in terms of what they want from the administration and student services, and I see the staff here as changing from what it was under Paul Ginsberg's direction.
But he would probably feel that there was less advocacy for the student than there had been, would he?
Gosh, you know, obviously you'll need to ask him that question.
What he actually said was that the issue is who will be the advocate for the students now, and sorry, I think his feeling.
Okay, we will continue to be very strong advocates for students. In fact, I had a case the other day. I want to be careful about this, but it involved a learning disabled minority student and a professional program where we felt that she needed an opportunity. She had been dropped from the program. She needed an opportunity to be readmitted to prove herself. And we went absolutely to the wall on that case, and we won the readmission. You know, I'm a person who, you know, absolutely adores students, and if I feel that, you know, if I'm going to make a mistake, I'm going to make it on the side of advocacy for the student and giving the student another opportunity or taking up the student's cause. And so I see us as continuing to be fierce advocates, and certainly if we feel a student has been wronged or treated unfairly, we will go to the wall with that. So I don't see our losing that
part
of it at all.
Oh, I don't either. I asked that question the wrong way. I certainly have gotten the feeling that a good many people thought there was too much counseling done here, and that it was a good idea to siphon it to the counseling center. Mm-hmm. And why isn't that accredited? Have they tried before?
Well, you know, we have a history here that goes back at least to the early 70s, where student services have not been well supported by the administration, and that's been a really big part of it, Laura. And I think, you know, the dollars. It's simply a matter of the dollars have not been there, and you know, when Paul Ginsburg or other people in student services have asked for funds, they simply haven't been able to get them. And I see us as entering a wonderful new era. First of all, I'm not shy about asking for money for student services, and secondly, I really think that we perform a critical and supportive role to, you know, the academic mission of the university. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I, you know, see us as working, you know, cooperatively with faculty, and I see myself as again, not shy in asking for increases in student services.
But presumably the failing to get accreditation has to do with the kind of people that you hire.
Well, no,
counseling.
We don't have
right?
enough people. We don't even
oh,
have
is
enough.
That, is that it?
We have to have a critical mass of at least 9 or 10 people in the counseling service to even apply for accreditation status. And until last year, we had 5. Two psychologists and 2 social workers and 1 person in guidance and counseling. And so, you know, this year, for instance, we're increasing the staff to 6. So we've got to get a critical mass of people before we can even fill out an application. And as I said, we have the lowest ratio of counselors or therapists to students of any of the Big Ten institutions. We are number 10, and number 9 is a lot in a lot better shape, you know, than we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so we've got a long way to go. We've got some real serious building to do.
Would that be explained by the fact that a lot of the counseling was being done here in the dean's office?
That's an explanation in part, Laura, but again, we fall so badly by the way when you do any comparisons. Mm-hmm. For instance, at Michigan State University, they have 14 full-time people in their counseling service. So, you know, there is a huge difference. You know, we did some of the counseling here because Paul wanted us to do it, and because our resources were inadequate, but that only tells part of the story. Mm-hmm. Certainly some of the academic advisors, some of the undergraduate advisors are superb, not only in their academic advising, but their counseling skills. Arlene Davenport over in psychology, Linda Newman, who used to be in history, who's now in the School of Education. But again, that only tells part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully, you know, we are entering a new era with the chancellor's concern with students in general and my willingness to pound my shoe on the table in terms of asking for, you know, more money and also telling the story of why student services are so important.
Yes, I think that would appeal to the legislature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true.
You don't yourself ever go down and lobby with the legislature, I don't suppose.
No, but I've been doing a lot of new things in this job, and I, for instance, I wouldn't be opposed, you know, to talking to the legislators if I needed to. I mean, I know some already, and certainly when I have an opportunity, and they're interested, I talk about the work that we're doing. We have just hired a new lobbyist, Mike Williamson, hired him away from the city of Madison. He was Joe Sensenbrenner's key person, and I haven't met with Mike yet to talk about strategies on student services, but I'm sure that I will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question. I'm sort of taking up some points that have come up in talking to Paul.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with cheating, mm-hmm. academic dishonesty, mm-hmm. which is apparently a big issue. It's been a very painful mm-hmm. one, and I'd like to know what your policy is going to be on that.
Okay, well, first I should tell you for the historical record that this year, for reasons we don't understand at all, the number of academic misconduct cases coming into the Dean of Students' Office has doubled, absolutely doubled
since
from
you
last
took
year.
Office?
Yes, yes. Mm. And I do not know why that is, but I think that's interesting to get on the historical record. First of all, the academic misconduct policy was drafted, created, approved by the faculty, and ultimately the Faculty Senate, by the Board of Regents, by all the powers that be. Our office has had the job of administering this policy, which includes full due process rights for students. And I want to back up to tell you that when I was an undergraduate, one day I was in a large history class, and we were getting back an examination, and the professor in the class pointed to the fellow sitting next to me. First, I thought he was pointing at me, and I was terrified. And he actually said in class, "Hey, you there, seat number 162, I believe that you cheated on your exam. Get out of here and don't ever come back to this class." And that was in a time when students had no due process rights. And so I think that it is extremely important that we have a policy in place that enables a professor or teaching assistant to bring a charge of academic misconduct against a student, and at the same time that the student then have an opportunity to respond and to have a hearing. So I really believe that it's an important process. The problem is that whenever you have due process, you're talking about lots of time, you're talking about a cumbersome process. Justice, takes time. It absolutely takes time. So our office is administering what appears to be a fairly cumbersome policy. And faculty have come to believe that it is our policy because it's our office that is administering it. And they get pretty frustrated in that, you know, yes, there's a lot of documentation required if you believe someone has cheated on an exam, and you have to have the written documentation, you have to have a certain number of hearings. And so there's been an extreme amount of frustration with our office over the academic misconduct policy. And it's my understanding that right now, under the direction of system, the academic misconduct policy, is your tape running out?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's my understanding that there is an actually University of Wisconsin system, it's a system committee that is reviewing the academic misconduct procedures. And I don't think they're making a whole lot of progress in terms of trying to streamline the procedure so that it is not as cumbersome as it is presently. I am not by any means an expert in this area. There are two other people on our staff who specifically work in academic misconduct, Roger Howard, the associate dean, and then Assistant Dean Peggy Mizio, and they could speak much more articulately, you know, to this than I can. But I would like to find a way to do two things. First of all, to streamline the process so that it would not be as cumbersome as it is now, and secondly, to help faculty members understand that this is not our procedure, but is rather a procedure that was created and developed by the faculty of this institution. And if I could do those two things, it would make me very pleased.
So you wouldn't change the underlying policy?
Due process, the due process procedure for students, I would not change. Mm. And just as I would not change my due process rights if I'm accused of stealing from my neighbor, you know, I want to be innocent until I'm proven guilty, and that's a constitutional principle for which I'm prepared to bleed and die and fight, because I really believe in it.
I know that there's been considerable dissatisfaction in the faculty and in the chancellor's office at the inability to in any way penalize students who are cheating. Mm-hmm. And
well, it's interesting. I think I can quote Peggy Mizio and Roger Howard on this, that when they have cases that go to hearing, you know, that are reviewed by the full hearing committee, the Student Conduct Policy Committee, which again has a majority of faculty, about half the cases go in the favor of students and the other half go against them. You know, these are cases that actually reach hearing, and certainly there are penalties. You know, it's quite interesting to me that it depends on who's on trial. For instance, if I'm angry with a student for cheating, then I want that student punished, you know, immediately. If I'm the student who is accused of cheating, then I want my full due process rights. It's sort of like it depends on your, you know, perspective. I think about what's happening now with regard to racial harassment cases, where people are very emotional and very angry, very outraged about racial harassment. And when someone is accused of racial harassment, they want that person suspended before they've had any opportunity to ascertain the facts or before that person has had a due process hearing. Okay. And, you know, I think it's really, again, important that we protect a person's constitutional right to be heard and to see what the facts and circumstances are in the case. And that takes time.
So
that
you
takes
equate
time.
Cheating with racial harassment.
What I'm saying is there's some principles here that when a faculty member is angry because he believes that a student has cheated or she believes that a student has cheated.
You think it's just believe. You don't think it's possible to know.
Well, sometimes it's possible to know. Sometimes there is a very clear case where a faculty member catches somebody red-handed, you know, and sees them flashing numbers on their fingers to another, you know, student in terms of the exam.
Or has a passage from a board.
It's very, very clear. Sometimes it's very clear. Just as sometimes it's very clear that I stole the book from my neighbor. Okay, it's very clear. At the same time, what I'm saying is our basic constitutional right is such that we are innocent until we're proven guilty. And a key part of that is due process. And even though you saw me steal that book from my neighbor, I still have a right to get in there and say, but I didn't. And my feeling is that in general, if a student is caught red-handed, that he or she admits to that. I don't see a lot of frivolous cases coming through the academic misconduct process, that when they come through, it's cases that are gray, not cases that are clear cut. Mm. For instance, with general misconduct cases, someone setting off a fire alarm or stealing or beating up on another student, if I get them in the office and I look them straight in the eye and I say, look, the police report is pretty clear, there were six witnesses, they generally fess up and say, you know, yes, I did do this, and then we impose a disciplinary punishment. So the cases that are contested generally, whether it's academic misconduct or, you know, something downtown, are cases that are gray, cases that are not clear-cut. I can think of a lot of cases, academic misconduct cases, that are just settled in the first informal hearing because the student says, yes, I did this, and the professor sends the student a letter with the penalty, and the letter comes to our office, and it's part of the record.
Mm-hmm. Well, just one little other question on that. Paul said that freshmen often didn't know what plagiarizing was. In your SOAR program, will that be a subject that you will educate students on?
Absolutely, definitely. And we would include in our expanded orientation efforts expectations on the part of the university. And, you know, one of my clear expectations would be that there would be no cheating of any kind, no academic misconduct. And although I believe that most students know something about what academic misconduct is, I have no problem with making that crystal clear to students during orientation, just as I would want to settle on some expectations with regard to human rights. And we would make that clear and put students on notice, so to speak, about academic misconduct, and then you wouldn't have the feedback that, you know, they had never been told what academic misconduct was. But I don't agree with Paul in that, you know, I think most people do have some understanding. They may not know the word plagiarism exactly, but they know that if they go to the Encyclopedia Britannica and copy a paragraph and put it in the paper, that there's something that doesn't ring right about that. Mm. Where do we want to start?
I'm asking you for what is concerning you at the moment.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think that we've got to embark on an era that is what I would call a pro-family era within the university, where, you know, as I said last time, the family and the workplace are working in harmony with each other. That's extremely important to me. And that has significant ramifications for the university. For instance, let's take a situation. We have one right now where there is an absolutely brilliant woman that one of the departments wants to bring here as a faculty member. And it's an area, particular area where they've lost a number of people and they need this woman. She's critical, you know, to their program. She wants to come here, and her husband is in student services and in counseling, and she is only willing to come here if we can find a spot for him. And, you know, we have at Wisconsin not paid attention to these, you know, academic dual career, you know, marriages. And my clear position, and I believe that the chancellor would underwrite this, is that we want to do everything we can to keep families, you know, together. At the same time, we don't want to compromise, you know, our hiring practices such that we bring people on board that we ordinarily, you know, wouldn't bring. So there's a very delicate balance here. And I think we just made a big step forward in changing our recruitment procedures such that if we have this kind of situation where, for instance, a department wants to hire someone and has made an offer, that we can short-circuit our ordinary recruiting procedures and plug the spouse into the field of candidates that's being looked at for another position within the university. And so I think this business of family, I think it's going to be called family recruiting in the years ahead, because we clearly want to bring many more women into the university, and a huge percentage of these women have families, and the only way we're going to be able to do it is if we expand our horizons with regard to flexibility on these spouse hires. So I think that's extremely important, and I think we will, in our comprehensive report that we're preparing for the Futures Committee and the Chancellor from the University Child Care Committee, that there will be some mention of, you know, family recruiting and again, the university becoming more flexible. You know, I think we've got to do lots of things. For instance, I have an assistant dean vacancy, and I am actually thinking about splitting that position into two positions such that I could hire, you know, two people, and perhaps one of these people would be a father or a mother with, you know, young children who wanted to be working, you know, half-time instead of, you know, full-time. In my own office, I have instituted pro-family policy such that, and maybe I mentioned this last time, you know, anything that we can do for our employees generally to make sure that, you know, the workplace and family aren't colliding, all these kinds of things I think are going to be extremely important. And I think we're never going to succeed in affirmative action unless we really start addressing these family issues. In fact, I may have said this last time, but it's so important to me, I'll say it one more time. The biggest piece of unfinished business in affirmative action are family issues. That's the major stumbling block, is, you know, improving you know, child care, the availability of child care, flexibility and employment. And you know, we're never going to get very far unless we really get going in this area and get going fast.
Now, has this been discussed at you're going to the dean's meetings now.
Mm-hmm.
Has it been discussed among the deans?
It's just beginning to be discussed. As a matter of fact, yesterday, one of our most fabulous deans...
it's the wire I'm worried about.
Oh, am I twisting the wire here? One of our greatest deans, and I hope you get a chance to interview him, Dean Hamilton McCubbin in the School of Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, one of our most forward-thinking, visionary deans, approached each of the deans to ask for money to take two of our child care programs out of crisis for the immediate, you know, future. And he actually called me and said that he had a commitment on dollars from a number of the deans in the other schools and colleges, which thrilled me. It thrilled me for two reasons. One is that I have been a spokesperson in the wilderness pretty much on these issues. I've been carrying this family banner for a long time, and I haven't felt very well supported. So it thrills me that another dean, sees the situation the same as I do. And secondly, that he is willing to go out and stump for funds for childcare, and that other deans see this as important now and are willing to ante up some money. So to answer your question, these issues, spouse hires, children and family issues, are just beginning to really get an airing in the dean's meetings and in the university administrative council, and it's very thrilling to me. And again, I'm always surprised, because I feel like I have not been very well supported, you know, in these areas. And yet at the same time, my own common sense and my own life experience tells me that these are critically important areas, more so to women than to men, because women are the primary caregivers. And, you know, again, that we've got to address this area and address it very quickly.
But won't you be called if you, on giving a priority to a, let's say, a husband of a wife that you want, from people who believe that there should be a, who work so hard to get a search and screen process for jobs?
First of all, I guess, put in perspective, I think that the number of these academic couple situations, although they will increase, they will never be the majority of our hires. They will be the minority, you know, part. At the same time, I would stress again that, you know, our greatest natural resource is our children, and most of these couples will be having, you know, children, and that we've got to pay attention to it, that this whole area has been neglected, you know, for way too long. So I feel that I can defend it, you know, very, very well. I don't feel a bit defensive about it. I think it's real important.
Well, let's say that there is a husband who wants a job in the student dean's office, but you have a very good woman candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you handle that?
Well, you know, the hiring is always going to be left with the department. And I think what, for instance, what Phil Certain, the associate vice chancellor, could do in this case is to alert me to the situation, to do some advocacy, to make sure that I take a close look at both the people, but in the end, the hiring decision is going to be up to me, and I am going to try to get the very best person that I can for the job. And, you know, in that situation, if the woman's credentials were, you know, vastly superior to the man's credentials, then I would probably go with hiring, you know, the woman. What I'm saying to you, Laura, is that we have not been willing to take marital status or significant other status into account at all in the university in hiring, and now we're paying attention to it and sensitizing people to it, but we're by no means making hiring decisions for departments. I would not want to see that happen. So it's kind of a new level of sensitivity.
Well, it would certainly be interesting to hear what, if this were, you say it hasn't been discussed as such as a policy in the dean's meeting.
Yeah, it has not.
Mm-hmm.
It has not. Mm-hmm. We're just beginning to talk about it in this recruitment, change in the recruitment practices. That policy just came out in January, I think, mm-hmm. something like that, from the Associate Vice Chancellor's office.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how all this shakes out. Yeah. It's complicated.
It's a very long way from nepotism, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's complicated business. But I think we must pay attention to it, particularly if we are concerned about bringing women into the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which we are, of course. You know,
yeah.
We've got a long way to go in that whole area. And when I say women, I'm talking about majority women and minority women. Yes, I do. I am a part of the Management Development Seminar, which is a wonderful seminar of 25 or 30 mid-level managers and a couple of top managers like myself. It's like a graduate course. It is organized and taught primarily by Dr. Jill Kaufman. And it meets every couple weeks on Friday morning. And I was asked 2 weeks ago to give a talk about children, family, and child care issues in the workplace. And keep in mind that most all the people in management development are male. There may be five or six women. And so I prepared a very careful talk and started with my story about the baby room out at the University of Oregon, which is a wonderful example of this head-on collision between work and family. And I talked about wanting to get the call on a Wednesday afternoon for my 11-year-old saying there's a crisis at home, the crisis being that there are not enough popsicles in the freezer, that was just as important to me as meeting with the University Administrative Council and the chancellor, that, you know, home and family issues and workplace issues are equally important. So anyway, I talked along in that vein. And after the meeting, several men approached me and said, I had no idea, absolutely no idea, being a traditional male and having, you know, a wife who stayed at home and was a homemaker and raised the children, of the kinds of responsibilities that you as a professional woman are trying to carry, and this balance of, you know, trying to get your budget submitted and at the same time trying to pick up your youngster's bicycle so that he can ride to school tomorrow because it's been in the repair shop and he's really frustrated. And essentially, I mean, those are pretty superficial examples, popsicles and bicycles, but, you know, could be a sick child or, you know, whatever. And essentially these men said, I had no idea of what kind of pressure you're under. And this wasn't a depressed speech that I was making. Mm-hmm. It was a, you know, here's the reality of my life as a woman, as a top manager. Here are the kinds of issues that I'm facing, and the family still wants a family dinner and wants me to cook, and the chancellor wants me, you know, out and around at the Founders Day speeches or whatever. And it surprised me, actually. It shouldn't have, but it surprised me that as many men approached me and said, you have raised our consciousness in a way that our consciousness simply wasn't there. And one of those people that was in that seminar is one of the people that approved money for child care yesterday.
One of the deans.
Right, or one of the associate deans. So it was real interesting. So I guess that's an example of what you would, is that what you mean?
It's the opposite kind of an example. The other case had to do with a feeling that the men had established an understanding among themselves and solved a problem by doing so, that was not the way that she would have solved it. Mm-hmm. But it's just as well to have an example such as you're giving. That's interesting. You got no criticism then.
I actually got no criticism. Several people were very complimentary, and I had spent a great deal of time preparing my remarks because I am very, very careful in terms of wanting to really convey, what this is all about and how complicated, you know, it is. For instance, in part of my talk, I had picked out an ad from the New York Times. I don't know if I mentioned this when we talked last. An ad that had absolutely made me furious. It was an ad with a woman in her 30s and her husband and a small child, their small child, and it said essentially, this woman is a real estate broker, she's beautiful, she's got it all together, her four-year-old is the valedictorian in his preschool class, and, you know, she can do everything. And what made me furious about this ad was, first of all, placing a four-year-old in that kind of competitive environment, which just infuriated me. I think that's grossly unfair because I believe in childhood and I don't believe in laying that competition on that early. Here. But what made me even more furious was if I thought about myself in an ad and I thought about the people that are supporting me and helping me so that I can be in this top spot, there'd probably be 200 people in my ad, from the woman who comes in and helps, clean and take care of my house, to, you know, my older son who's willing to run to the dry cleaners to pick up my suit that I need for, you know, there just it takes so many people, and that's what I was trying to convey to the people in Management Development Seminar. Unless we have more support for women who, as long as they continue to be the primary caregivers, women are just going to come unglued or crack up trying to get tenure or trying to be successful in the workplace, because you've got to have a lot of people behind you, supporting you, helping you. And that was what I was trying to really get across. And I think I did get that notion, you know, across. I tried to do it humorously. You know, but when I talk about popsicles and, you know.
Sounds good. Why don't you publish it?
Maybe I will. Maybe I will. So, anyway, that's my story.
We're just at the end of the tape. Yeah.